Best Foot Forward, written and read by me, Adam Hills. Best Foot Forward. So, see, it's forward, but it's also forward because it's the beginning of the book. Little joke for you. Hi there. Before you start listening to my book, I thought I'd let you know what you're in for. In essence, this is a compilation of stories from a life of comedy. Nearly 30 years of tales from the road, the stage, and the screen. My original idea was that you could listen to the book at any time, maybe go through a wee chapter, come back to it whenever you felt the need. Ideally, I imagined you listening to this book on the toilet, delving in and out as time permitted. Literally, a wee chapter at a time. However, as I compiled story after story, I came to realise that this isn't just a random collection of adventures. It's a journey, as every life is. When I started doing comedy, I had no idea where it would lead me, or what it would teach me about myself. I just wanted to make people laugh. I still do. Along the way, though, I found laughter had some positive side effects. May cause happiness, may improve your mood, may have health benefits, may change the way you look at yourself and the world around you. All of those side effects have held true for me. I've seen authors use a profound quote to start their book, and my first instinct was to drop a bit of Mark Twain on you. The two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. However, a quick internet search tells me that Twain may not actually be responsible for that sentiment after all, and I'd hate to start a book about comedy by misappropriating someone's line. So instead, I'd like to paraphrase from the character Hawkeye in the TV series MASH. I don't want to change the world, just my little corner of it. What does all of this mean? Well, I guess it means I hope you enjoy this book and that you get something out of listening to it, because I got a lot out of writing it. More than I expected. Happy listening. Part 1. Early Days. Chapter 1. The Hillsy Kids. When I first told my mum I was going to try stand-up comedy, she simply said, "But you're not funny." It just made me all the more determined to do it. She hates it when I tell that story, but I can see why she did it. As the words left my mouth, I'm sure she had visions of me chucking in my university degree, foregoing my plans to become a journalist, and winding up celebrating my 40th birthday rummaging through a mini-skip for a candle. For the record, I did finish the degree, my dreams of journalism were put on hold, and I celebrated my 40th birthday by watching Toy Story 3 in 3D with family and friends. Maybe at 19, comedy was my way of rebelling against my parents. Not alcohol, nor drugs, or even girls, but comedy, the most addictive vice of them all. It is ironic, really, since comedy had always been what bound us together as a family. If you were to ask me when I was at my happiest as a child, I'd say it was sitting in the car with my mum, dad, and younger brother Brad, listening and laughing along to comedy tapes. Whenever the school holidays rolled around, we'd pile into our beige, although Dad swore the colour was Sahara tan, Ford Fairmont, with the pinstriping up the side, and begin the four-hour drive down the coast from the southern suburbs of Sydney to my grandparents' house in the seaside town of Churros Head in New South Wales. Home to around 2,000 residents, Churros Head gave the world Eva Mylott, an internationally acclaimed opera singer of the early 1900s whose grandson went on to become an internationally acclaimed actor. You may have heard of Mel Gibson. There is also a rumour that the parents of Flea from the band Red Hot Chili Peppers now reside in Churros Head, and that occasionally he can be spotted at the bar of the local golf club. You can recognise him because he's naked with a three-wood cover over his willy. To Australians, our holidays were nothing out of the ordinary, but to British people, they were the most Australian thing anyone ever did, ever. When my dad's parents retired, they left Sydney for Churros and a four-bedroom, two-storey brick house, built specifically to be invaded sporadically by their children and grandchildren. If you walked out the front door, crossed the road and followed the street for 10 minutes, you had a choice of beaches at which to spend your day. There was One Tree Beach, so named because it was overlooked by a headland with one tree on it, Rock Beach, it had lots of rocks around it, and Whale Beach. A whale once died there. The whole family would often spend the entire morning body surfing, boogie boarding and sunbathing before heading back to Nana and Pa's for lunch. Then we'd go back to the beach and do it all again in the afternoon. Alternatively, Brad and I would walk out the back door in the morning, go down to the bottom of the yard, then into the long grass behind the house in search of kangaroos. Sometimes we'd have spotted them already from the top balcony, but by the time we had galumphed our way through the waist-high grass, the ruse would scarper. In which case, we'd come home and play backyard cricket. If my cousins had come across from Canberra, we'd have a fine old game that could take an entire afternoon. Occasionally, we'd get a visit and a few tips from Nana's brother-in-law, a former New South Wales cricketer by the name of Bill Donaldson, who was legendary in our family for having played alongside the great Don Bradman. Every now and then, the neighbours would join in, and although I don't remember it, my grandfather still delights in telling the story of the time little George Gregan from a few doors up came to play. He went on to represent Australia in more rugby union games than any other player. At the time, though, he was just another kid and would probably have joined us in searching for any balls that were hit over the boundary into the long grass for six. Sometimes we'd extend the boundary to the line of trees and place a fielder in the waist-high grass. Of course, the length of the grass made it impossible to run, so the fielder was only effective if the ball was hit directly to them. Plus, they had to be aware of snakes. If not cricket or body surfing, or the odd game of tennis, the other main activity was sailing. Coiler Lake was visible from my grandparents' back balcony, and my dad and uncle had gone halves in a 12-foot catamaran. If the wind was right, we'd hitch it up on a trailer, take it to the lake, and sail to our heart's content. When Nana saw the boat make the final run of the day, she'd put the scones in the oven, and they'd be on the table by the time we made it home. It was idyllic, and throughout it all, we laughed. A lot. When we weren't watching the Two Ronnies or the Dick Emery Show, we were quoting from them. I lost count of the amount of times I saw my grandfather impersonate a Benny Hill character with the phrase, "Everybody crapping!" Like I said, though, the laughter started on the way there. As we wound our way through the lush, green, dairy country of the New South Wales south coast, with cows on either side of the car and the occasional dead wombat by the edge of the road, Mum, Dad, Brad and I would pop a cassette in the car stereo and giggle along to the comedy stylings of Bill Cosby. He was the family-friendly comedian, the one everyone could enjoy, and even when he was a bit risque, it was funny to hear the squeaky clean family man be slightly rude. Oh, how we'd all chuckle at his story of zoning in on the ugly girl at parties, because the ugly ones are always the night ones. Or the routine about Spanish fly, which is apparently an aphrodisiac one puts in a lady's drink to make them more attracted to you. How were we to know he would later be accused of being a sexual predator who drugged women's drinks in order to have sex with them? I mean, it's not like he actually talked about it in his act. Retrospective inappropriateness aside, those car trips and the family holidays that ensued represent some of the purest moments of a pretty happy childhood. I sometimes think my entire comedy career might be simply an ongoing attempt to recreate those moments of joy. I grew up in the leafy southern suburbs of Sydney, in a place called the Sutherland Shire. The Shire, as it's now known across Sydney, boasted of being, quote, the birthplace of a nation, since it was here that Captain Cook first came ashore in 1770 on the southern edge of Botany Bay. 8 years later, when the first fleet arrived to set up a penal colony, Captain Arthur Phillips surveyed the area and immediately realised it had no fresh water and was too marshy to sustain a bustling civilisation, so he took his ships around the corner to what is now known as Sydney Harbour. The Shire has had an inferiority complex ever since. It also has a reputation for being somewhat sheltered, and in the 70s it reportedly had the highest concentration of white Anglo-Australians of any place in Australia. Author Kathy Lett also grew up in the Shire and still refers to it as the Insular Peninsula. My day-to-day life at home pretty much resembled the holiday life I experienced at my grandparents', except that the city was closer, the beach was further away, and instead of long grass behind the house, we had dense bushland. Bob and Judy Hills owned a house on a steep, rocky block of land. To park the car in the carport, you had to back it down from the road onto a curving concrete driveway, which dropped away on the right to a native garden of bottle brush trees, the occasional blue-tongue lizard, and a massive gum tree overlooking it all. There was also a native bush whose flowers turn red just before Christmas. It's called a Christmas bush. We call it like we see it. Alighting the car, one would walk down three steps and a path, then onto a sloping ramp my mum's father had built out of discarded railway sleepers. The ramp would carry visitors over the rock and shrubs to the front door, a good 5 or so metres below street level. By the time you exited the back door, you had to take a flight of stairs down to the yard. The back of the house was raised on brick stilts, and underneath was mainly dirt and rubble. Over time, that area was enclosed and renovated to become what Aussies of a certain era call a rumpus room, an all-purpose open-plan entertaining area that in our case included a pool table, a pot-bellied stove, and Dad's bar. It goes without saying that a swimming pool was also added to the backyard. The sounds of summer for me are splashing, running, laughing, and more splashing. Of course, while we were making those noises ourselves, our neighbours up and down the street were making the same noises in their pools. Sometimes the water from their splashes would make it over the shared fence and into our yard. Behind the back fence, though, was the world's best play area. The bush. Gum trees, wattles, more gum trees, gymea lilies, and a whole lot more gum trees. All scrabbling their way down to a creek at the bottom of the valley, then scrabbling their way back up the other side. Forts were built, games were played, names were carved in rocks, and magazines were stashed in caves. And when our mums wanted us home, all they had to do was call, and their voices would echo through the valley. And the wildlife? Cockatoos would regularly screech overhead, along with kookaburras, magpies, brightly coloured rosellas, and flocks of galahs. Now, Australian listeners might like to just zone out for a moment while I explain to Brits that 1, galahs do exist. 2, they are a pink and grey bird. 3, they make an almighty high-pitched raucous screech that is unpleasant to the ear. 4, which is why the term galah is applied to anyone who is a bit of a loudmouth fool. And 5, which is why Alf in Home and Away often called someone a flamin' galah. It wasn't uncommon to come home from school and see a dozen sulphur-crested cockatoos perching on the railing of the back balcony. One friendly kookaburra took to sitting inside the kitchen windowsill while Mum cooked dinner, hoping for a sneaky offcut. Oh, look, sure, there were snakes as well. We once caught a deadly funnel-web spider in their swimming pool, but, you know, we just accepted that as part of the lifestyle. We all learnt to shake our shoes out before putting them on, in case a spider had crawled in. I mean, it's just common sense. It didn't occur to me that I only needed to check my left shoe, since my right foot was prosthetic. Any spider sinking its fangs into that rock-hard rubber sole would need an immediate dental appointment. But even though I was born without a right foot, I was raised to do what everyone else did, so I bashed both Dunlop volleys against the front step. My parents had received the invaluable advice to, quote, treat him like any other normal kid. So they enrolled me in a gymnastics class at a young age. It taught me coordination, strength, and athleticism, and even now, I can still do a handy cartwheel. It wasn't the only advice they received. Just after I was born, Mum visited a specialist who told her I would never walk or have a normal life. Distraught, she returned to her GP and told him the news. He suggested she get another opinion, and thankfully the second specialist said that the first specialist was talking bollocks. The specialist to whom I owe the most, though, was the one who saw me immediately after I was born, Professor Richard Jones. Whisked away from my mother before she could even hold her baby, I was presented to a group of surgeons who suggested my foot should be amputated directly below the knee. Who knew what the little wobbly thing was at the end of my stump? Best to cut it off. Professor Jones said he thought the wobbly thing was an ankle of sorts, and keeping it intact would mean I'd have a more natural gait later in life. That one decision enabled me to run, walk, skip, and do just about everything that the other kids could do. Sometimes better. Many years later, when I did my first ever solo stand-up comedy show at the Sydney Opera House, I made sure Professor Jones was there. And that's the last you'll hear of my foot for a while, because, in truth, it didn't really enter into my life that much. Yearly trips to the prosthetist were merely par for the course. I'd have a few days off school, Mum and I would take the train into the city, we'd do puzzles or read while my foot was being made, and we'd have a milkshake afterwards. Sweet! The other kids didn't treat me any differently because I didn't do anything different. Half the year, you couldn't even see the prosthetic anyway because I was wearing trousers. One summer, a kid on my street reacted in shock when I wore shorts for the first time that year. "What happened to your leg?" he exclaimed before clocking my expression, then adding, "Oh yeah, sorry, I forgot you've got one foot." It never occurred to me that having a prosthetic foot was anything out of the ordinary. One of my dad's mates came to the house once with his leg in a cast. It was hidden below his jeans, so he knocked on his shin, which then made a loud clunking noise. "I bet you can't do that," he dared. I then reached down and knocked on my jeans, and the exact same sound came from underneath. He looked startled, my parents burst into laughter, and I just sat there bemused, wondering what was so funny. By and large, though, I considered myself lucky that I could do everything. Except wear thongs. I mean, it was Australia in the 70s, and everyone wore thongs. Oh, and for British listeners, our thongs are what you call flip-flops. At no stage did my lack of a foot preclude me from wearing a G-string. My prosthetist once asked if there was anything I really wanted to do, so I said, "Yeah, I want to wear thongs." Okay, British listeners, just stop laughing. Nothing fancy, just I just want to wear your standard blue rubber thong. Seriously, stop it, British listeners. So my prosthetist made me a foot with toes, but without the ability to grip with those toes. The thong just kept flying off whenever I walked. So my mum glued Velcro to the bottom of the foot and the top of the thong to try and keep it on. It didn't work, but it was a valiant effort. Thankfully, a few years later, sandals came back into fashion and I was saved. All right, so that is the last you'll hear of my foot for a while. The rest of my childhood was mainly spent playing sport. In the winter it was rugby league, in the summer it was cricket, and all year round it was tennis. Eventually, golf entered the picture as well. Occasionally, my prosthetic would break, usually while playing rugby league, and I'd have to hobble home from the local oval with it slung over my shoulder. I once reassured an open-mouthed dog walker with the words, "Don't worry, mate, it's just a broken leg." The irony, of course, is that I was born without a right foot, and yet, somehow, I'm right-footed. I don't know why, it just felt like the correct foot to kick with. Until the day I tried to kick a goal from the 20-metre line and the prosthetic snapped below the ankle mid-kick. The ball went 5 metres, my foot flew 10, and the next day I taught myself to kick left-footed. It still feels unnatural, though. All right. That is the last you'll hear of my foot for a while. My point is, despite being born with one foot and growing up surrounded by lethal snakes and spiders, I had a fun, carefree, and relatively sporty childhood. Chapter 2. A Star is Norm. My dad was responsible for my comedy education, directly and indirectly. An unfailingly polite man with sparkling eyes, sandy blonde hair, and an inbuilt desire to make sure everyone else was happy, Bob Hills was perfectly suited to his job as a member of the Qantas cabin crew. Although my father's career meant he spent a lot of time away from us, when he was home all day. So once our homework was done, Dad would sit with us and watch whatever was on TV, usually old episodes of MASH, or our favourite, The Bugs Bunny Show. He also had a love of comedy, and together we'd listen to albums by Peter Sellers and Alan Sherman. If I close my eyes now, I can hear my dad impersonating an in-character Sellers describing how toothbrushes are made.
"The little holes in the top are put in manually, or in other words, once a year."
Anyone familiar with my recent work on The Last Leg won't be surprised to know that Alan Sherman was famous for putting new words to old tunes to create some of the first comedy song parodies. "Hello, Marta, hello, Fada, here I am at Camp Granada" was one of his hits. As we grew older, so did our comedic references, and Mel Brooks became a household favourite. There's a scene in Brooks's History of the World Part 1 where a gathering ends with the call, "Let's end the meeting on a high note," at which all involved sing an operatic high note. Our family ended every get-together like that from the moment we saw the movie to the moment my dad died. It was literally the last thing he said to me. Dad's job also meant we could fly around the world for free on staff travel, but on one condition: we flew standby. That meant rocking up at the airport, bags packed, house locked, fridge empty, and then hoping there would be 4 seats available on whatever flight we had chosen. Which is why my first ever international journey was spent sitting 3 rows in front of my parents. I was 9, Brad was 6, and we were all flying to Los Angeles. As the plane levelled off and the headsets were distributed, I discovered the In-Flight Comedy Channel, which featured a Danish comedian and pianist by the name of Victor Borger. It was the funniest, most amazing thing I'd ever heard. This strange man making people laugh about phonetic punctuation and classical piano. Apparently, I stood up on my seat and yelled 3 rows back to my parents, "Mom, Dad, there's a man being funny on the radio." Of course, I'd heard comedy before at home and in the car, but this was the first time I became aware that other people listened to it as well. I spent the rest of the flight letting the program replay over and over, knowing which jokes were about to appear and marvelling as the audience discovered them for the first time. Later that year, my first ever comedy appearance took place. It was a school performance day, Sutherland Primary School to be precise, and I had written a comedy play called Super Norm. Super Norm was based on Norm, a particularly Australian cartoon character invented for a national Get Fit campaign called Life Be In It. It is still one of the best ideas for a public campaign I've ever seen. Norm was a beer-gutted couch potato, constantly exhorted by his sister Libby to do some sort of physical activity. With a jingle every Australian knew by heart and can still repeat to this day, we as a nation got off our collective asses to be in it today, live more of your life. Anyway, this gave me the idea for Supernorm, a superhero whose only discernible power was that he could deflect anything with his enormous gut. Bullets, beer cans, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune were all repelled by his wobbly belly. From memory, I wrote, directed, cast, starred in, and even designed my own costume. Bond's t-shirt, stubby shorts, terry toweling hat, and a pillow for my stomach. I honestly can't remember if it was funny, but I do remember having an absolute ball doing it. Around the same time, Paul Hogan debuted a TV character called Super Dag, a pillow-gutted superhero in a terry toweling hat and stubby shorts who deflected things with his beer gut. Coincidence? Or did he steal the idea from me? You be the judge. Most people think of comedians as being the joker in class, the person who interrupts every lesson with a line that makes all the other kids laugh and both enrages and tickles the teacher at the same time. That was not me. I was the quiet kid who did all his work and only spoke when spoken to. But when it was my turn to speak, I made sure it was funny. One presentation to the class took the form of a Morecambe and Wise routine, while another short story was so full of in-jokes about my classmates, it made no sense whatsoever to our teacher. A report card came home with a comment from my history teacher praising my sense of humour, and I was prouder of that than any of the marks or grades on the entire page. The closest I came to the entertainment industry was when one of our substitute teachers, Mr. Doyle, appeared in a TV ad for Pizza Hut. His one big moment came as he bit into a Super Supreme pizza and uttered the line, "Mmm, super!" As you can imagine, we trailed him around the school for weeks, mocking him with those words, and he left soon after. Had I known that Mr. John Doyle would later team up with a guy called Greg Pickhaver to form a comedy duo called Roy and HG, I would probably have been much nicer to him. Had he known that I would one day be universally mocked for appearing in my own embarrassing advert for KFC, he might have had a decent comeback. Years later, I interviewed John on TV, and he told me off-air that Janali Boys High was the roughest school at which he ever taught and was the reason he quit teaching. When he quoted some of the acts he witnessed at the school, like, you know, the one time a classmate had his teeth knocked out for throwing an orange at another classmate, I was shocked, not by the violence, but because it turns out that didn't happen at every other school. I thought they were all full of thugs and yobbos with the few nerdy swats sitting in the corner. Turns out it was just mine. Ask any comedian who it was that bullied them at school and they will instantly reply. I could tell you who my bullies were, but I could also tell you who I picked on. I wasn't at the top of the list of kids to bully, but I certainly wasn't one of the cool kids either. I was also painfully shy around girls. Maybe that shyness was what led me to comedy. Deep down, I wanted to be the guy who spoke effortlessly, commanded a room, and brought people to laughter whenever I wanted to. While the other kids were listening to Iron Maiden or AC/DC, I was listening to Kenny Everett and Billy Connolly. While the other kids were smoking behind the bike sheds, I was drawing my own comic strip. And while other kids might sneak away from a family holiday to meet girls and drink cheap booze, I snuck off with my brother from a family holiday in Las Vegas to see a young Jim Carrey perform at the Comedy Store. Brad was my comedy compadre. He was, and still is, 3 years younger than me. And whatever I watched, he watched. I could rattle off the shows we bonded over, or I could tell you that to this day we address each other in all correspondence as two characters played by Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry in the Ben Elton Penn sitcom Filthy Rich and Catflap. My daughters think it's hilarious that their dad and their uncle send messages to each other that start with, "Dear Poo Farty," and end with, "Love ya. Knob end." I recently told Stephen Fry that story, and he guffawed with laughter and told me how proud Ben Elton was when he came up with those names. I immediately texted Brad to let him know. My brother's part in my life can be explained in a story that began when I was 7 and he was 4. We'd taken a family holiday to Darwin to visit my mum's brother Kevin, who taught Aboriginal student teachers. One of his students was a friendly and hospitable man named Tom, who took it upon himself to show us around. At the end of the week, as a gift, he bestowed Indigenous names upon Brad and me after consulting with the elders of his tribe. I was, and still am, called Stingray, and my brother was named Saltwater. Over time, Tom became a close family friend and would visit us in Sydney, first alone and then later with his wife and daughter. It's fair to say he stood out in the whiteout that was the Sutherland Shire. The irony is, a quick scan of the local suburbs reveals Kirrawee, Gymea, Woolaware, Caringbah and Cronulla. All Indigenous words. My dad took Tom clothes shopping one day and the sales staff had no idea how to deal with him. It didn't help that Tom tried on a pair of dark brown shorts, then joked, "The good thing is, if I need to dress formal, I can just tell people I'm wearing trousers and no one will know the difference." Tom became the first Aboriginal person from Arnhem Land to earn a university degree and became a principal at Yirrkala Community School, where he was committed to combining Western and traditional ways of teaching and authored books on the subject. He left teaching to pursue a musical career and form the now famous band Yothu Yindi, whose single Treaty became a huge hit in Australia. Tom, under a new name, went on to be awarded Australian of the Year in 1992, and a few years later, I interviewed him over the phone for a radio station. I waited until the interview was done, then reintroduced myself as Bob and Judy's son. There was a pause, as I wondered if he still remembered me. After all, it had been at least 15 years since he'd stayed with my family, and even longer since he'd given me my new name. "Hey!" he exclaimed with joy. "Stingray, how are ya?" So, how does all this relate to my brother? Well, for years, I always felt like I got the better name. I mean, stingray is a cool-looking and sounding animal. I've since learned that the stingray is considered to be very family-oriented and a devoted and protective parent. But maybe he only named me that because I have a long barb at the end of one of my legs. Salt water, though, always seemed to me to be, well, the daggier of the two names. It's hard to draw a cool picture of salt water or to identify with it. And I always felt sorry for my brother. Recently, however, while discussing our names with the actor Shari Sebbins, who happens to be of Bardi Jabba Jabba heritage, she corrected me. "Nah, man," she opined. "Salt water is way better." When I asked why, she put my relationship with my brother into clear perspective. "'Cause stingray can't survive without salt water." Love you, Poofarty. Back at high school, while other kids were looking to careers in medicine or sport, my main goal was to deliver the farewell to the teachers when we left. It was a tradition at Janali Boys High that the vice-captain of the school would deliver a farewell speech slash comedy roast to the teachers at their final assembly. From the moment I saw it happen at age 12, I knew that was what I wanted to do. There was only one problem. When I reached my final year, I wasn't vice-captain. What to do? I really wanted to deliver that speech slash comedy routine, but I didn't want to take the mic away from someone else. As the day approached, I gently raised the topic of the teacher's speech with the vice-captain, who was one of the sportiest guys at the school, but hardly an orator. I, on the other hand, was on the school debating team and had taken part in a couple of public speaking competitions. I loved the act of debating and tried really hard to perfect the art of getting a laugh while making a point. On at least one occasion, we lost a debate because I was more focused on the jokes than the arguments. In fact, it was my enjoyment of public speaking that convinced me to give up my dreams of becoming a veterinarian and aim instead for a future in journalism. "So, are you going to do the farewell to the teacher's speech this year?" I inquired of our vice-captain while looking like I didn't care about the answer and was just, you know, making casual conversation. His face turned to ash. "Oh, I really don't want to," came the reply. "Do you want to do it instead?" "If you want me to," I offered, trying to hide my excitement. His face lit up. "Oh, that would be amazing," he beamed. "I've been dreading this speech ever since I became vice-captain." It really looked like I'd lifted a weight from his shoulders. A few weeks later, I delivered what I now consider to be my first stand-up comedy routine. The only joke I remember was one that referred to the head librarian, who operated a particularly strict regime, often ejecting students for the most minor of indiscretions. On the final day of school, some of the senior students had erected barbed wire around the entrance and put up "Danger, no entry" signs, to which I said, "It backfired though, because nobody was able to tell the difference." I know, comedy gold, right? The point is, the speech went well, it got big laughs, and I would confidently describe it as my best moment at high school. Mum later told me that as I left the stage, her sister turned to her and said, "He should be a comedian." Yep. That was the plan. And so it was, after a couple more years of listening to and watching Graham Bond, Rodney Rood and Robin Williams, I arrived at the Sydney Comedy Store on Wednesday the 13th of July 1989 for my first open mic spot. I had actually been introduced to The Store by one of my best mates, Dave Smeet, who used to sing at the club upstairs, and I was immediately smitten. With the club, I mean. It was everything I now know a comedy club should be, and had that lethal combination of being downstairs and having a low ceiling. It was once put to me that going underground to a club gives the audience a sense that they're going somewhere illicit, where the rules will be well and truly broken. A low ceiling creates a sense of bonding while also trapping the laughs in the room, allowing them to bounce around the crowd rather than be lost into the ether above the audience's heads. It soon became my favourite club in Sydney, and I watched enthralled every time I went. Names like George Smilovich, Vince Sorrenti and Ostentatious would headline the shows. But the person that struck me most was Bruno Lucia, under the stage name of Dino Valentino. Assuming an Italian accent and a demeanour that later saw him become a star in a sitcom called All Together Now, with the fondly remembered catchphrase, "Hey, cheeky babe!" Bruno was as slick as they come. Put simply, I wanted to do what he did. But how? How could a sheltered, virginal, 18-year-old university student from the Shire take the step to becoming a comedian? I didn't even know what an open mic night was. I had no idea that anyone could just rock up, put their name on a list, and go on stage that night. Only when I attended my second open mic night did I realise you didn't have to come up with a new act every time you went on stage. I spent my long bus rides to Macquarie University dreaming up routines and would then blurt them out to my classmates, who looked at me as if to say, "Dude, you're at uni. You're meant to be smoking joints, drinking beer and chasing girls, not working up a stand-up set." I waited until the university holidays came around. What was it about comedy and holidays? And decided on a date to make my stage debut. At first, I didn't tell my parents that I was going to try stand-up comedy. I just told them a group of us were going to the comedy store to celebrate my 19th birthday, which, for all intents and purposes, was true. However, as more and more friends started calling, saying they wanted to see me celebrate, it became pretty obvious something was going on. I think it's fair to say my first gig was stunningly unremarkable. If I had been the MC that night, I wonder what I would have thought of the 19-year-old me. A cocky young uni student who thinks he's funny, bringing along a table of mates to laugh at his compilation of smutty old jokes. Come to think of it, that's pretty much what the compere said after my act. I believe his exact words were, "Isn't it funny how the guys that talk about sex the most do it the least?" He received a round of applause for that. It's even fairer to say I was totally clueless. I think I had a decent amount of stage presence coming from my few years of high school debating, but there's a big difference between winning over a room of drunk audience members and convincing a classroom of students that compromise makes a good umbrella. When I look back on the material I delivered that night, I actively wince. Even now, I couldn't tell you how it went. Well, actually, I could, but I'm not going to. There were a few old jokes, a few more old jokes, and a crappy attempt at a song parody. I'm embarrassed to even remember it, so there's no way in hell I'm going to repeat the act here. My mates laughed heartily, bless them, then watched the rest of the acts without me as I sat at the comics table at the back of the room. I figured it would be inappropriate to perform a set, then spend the show sitting at the front table. Unfortunately, it looked like I was snubbing them, but despite my act, I was trying to be vaguely professional. I remember Ross Daniels was the headliner, but the night was pretty much a blur. As I left the room with my mates in tow, I'm sure nobody thought I'd be back. Again, what would I have said about the 19-year-old me as I left the building? Probably the same thing the MC said as I passed by. "Yep, it's all well and good when your mates are here, but next time try it in front of strangers." So that's what I did. On the 29th of November 1989, 6 months after my first stage set, my parents laid down the rule that I could only perform during uni holidays, I turned up to the new Comedy Store premises in Cleveland Street, Surry Hills. This time around, I had only three friends with me who complied with my request to sit demurely at the back of the room. I wanted to go head to head with a room full of complete strangers and learn once and for all whether or not I really was funny. I learnt a new phrase that night: to die on your ass. It started well enough. In fact, my first joke received a decent response. It was a fairly obvious line about a local rugby coach who had allegedly been caught in a compromising position in a gent's toilet block. I offered the thought that he originally wanted to become an Aussie rules football coach, but was turned down because he only knew how to score behinds. For British listeners, a behind is 1 point in Aussie rules, as opposed to a goal, which is six. Look, it was hardly comedy gold, but it got a big laugh, which is always handy on your first gag. Even now, I tell comics that are just starting out, look at me, the grand old dame of comedy, open with your second strongest joke, finish with your strongest. I was about to launch into joke number two when I received my first ever heckle. That joke's about 14 years old. Silence in the room. Now, to this day, I swear I wrote the joke myself. Whether or not I was the first person to have ever written that joke is a different story. I'm sure it's been told in some form ever since the word behind became a sporting term. Either way, I'd never heard it before. Besides, it was my second ever gig. What do you want from me up here? Even now, I'm proud of my response. What a coincidence. So's your girlfriend. And I received my first ever round of applause. For a brief moment, I felt like the king of the world. I'd been challenged to a gunfight in the street and returned fire with deadly accuracy. In my mind, I blew the smoke from the tip of my pistol and did that swirly thing that cowboys do before placing it back in the holster. There's a line in the Mel Brooks movie Blazing Saddles that describes what happened next. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad. That guy rode my ass for the rest of the set, and I folded like an origami swan. Not only had I made him look like an idiot, but I had attacked his girlfriend. He criticised my jokes, my shirt, and my existence, and I panicked. I tried to banter with him, failed dismally, and after 5 minutes of pain, loped off to a smattering of applause. I'm often asked what it's like when people don't laugh. I'll tell you this, they call it dying for a reason. I've died plenty of times since then, and I will probably die plenty more. I'm sure you're aware that most people's top fear in life is of speaking in front of an audience. I think the real fear is looking like an idiot in front of other people. But as anyone who has done it will tell you, it's not the end of the world. At the time, you feel like the world's biggest asshole, and that everyone on the planet knows what a loser you truly are. But the next day you wake up and realise you're still alive. Gradually, as you go about your business, it dawns on you that the gig wasn't beamed to the entire country, not even to your entire street, and that life does indeed go on. And as a comic, you come to understand that every death carries an inherent lesson. I was sitting backstage with my head between my knees trying to work out what had just happened when the MC came back and gave me his words of advice for dealing with hecklers. You went at him too early. It was a great line, but next time, wait until the audience hate him too, then go for the kill. Good advice, which was complemented by that of the headliner. And always have a few more heckle put-downs ready, because they'll keep coming back at you. It wasn't until I consoled myself with my mates that they inadvertently showed me what the real lesson was. Don't panic. They pointed out to me that the guy gave me the perfect opportunity for a put-down and I missed it. When I asked what he did for a living, he replied, "I work as an artist." My friends were convinced I was about to respond, "You work as an artist? Surely that's a contradiction in terms." But it never came. Always remember, you have the microphone and the ability. Trust yourself and you'll find what's funny. And above all, don't panic. Chapter 3. Hug Life. Sometimes I think it's a good thing for a comedian to die early in his or her career. It makes you question whether you truly want to do this job or whether you're only in it for the good times. That early death shook my confidence like you wouldn't believe, but for some insane reason I wanted to give it another go. Somewhere I knew I could do it, and now I wanted to prove it to myself. I wanted to do it properly. So when a friend suggested I hop up and do 5 minutes at one of his gigs, I didn't even need the thinking music. Peter Fox had been performing for a year or so when I started and was at the support act stage. He was appearing at the Palms Hotel Chalora alongside Bazza Banana and the headliner Ostentatious, and I had gone along to watch. Bazza Banana was a legend of Sydney comedy. Real name Barry Sanford, he was in his 70s, possibly even 80s, and had performed on the early Sydney vaudeville circuit with Roy Rean. He had lived through the advent of radio, film and television, and was still making a living as a live comedian amongst the purveyors of so-called alternative comedy. With a rubber face that he would contort into an impression of a Pekingese pup and jokes that could only be described as classics, everyone vaguely associated with the circuit loved him. "I bought myself a greyhound," he'd wheeze. "Painted a bus on the side." Sensational. Occasionally, age would take its toll and the joke would come out wrong. "I bought myself a bus, painted a greyhound on the side." But his delivery was so good, it would still get a laugh. Baz opened the show and introduced Peter, who did a crack in 15 minutes. Meanwhile, the owner was starting to panic. Austin hadn't arrived. Although 3 years after his number one hit, Australiana, Ostentatious was still the man, and there was a roomful of people who had paid good money to see him. Baz got back up and did another 15 minutes of impressions and jokes, after which Peter suggested I do a 5-minute spot. I mean, like I said, no thinking music required. Baz introduced me and I delivered my opening gag, the one about the disgraced football coach. Remember? He wanted to coach Australian rules, but he only knew how to score behinds. And a funny thing happened. I got a round of applause for a joke. A joke that I had written. A room full of people liked my joke so much that they laughed and clapped their hands. From that moment on, I was hooked. The rest of the set went well, and when the club owner stood up and told the crowd it was only my third ever gig, there was more applause. Austin arrived and did his set, but to be honest, I didn't pay too much attention. I did it. I had stood before a room of strangers and made them laugh, and it felt amazing. I spent the rest of the night floating. I was more excited than I had ever been and accepted the congratulations of passing audience members like a proud bridegroom. I turned to Baz and asked the only question I really wanted the answer to, and I figured after at least 60 years in the business, he was the person to ask. Do you still feel like this when you've had a good gig? All the time, he replied without even thinking about it. All the time. It's the best job in the world. And with that, he gave me a hug. Later, as Peter and I wandered back to the car, he paused as he opened the door. You're going to go a long way in comedy. A long way. What makes you say that? I asked. Because Barry Sanford gave you a hug. And so a career and an addiction was born. It's fair to say my parents weren't entirely enamoured by my new career path. And yet, they also made me the comedian I am today. After 3 or 4 attempts at stand-up, I brought home a videotape of one of my performances. In an attempt at encouragement, Mum persuaded Dad to sit down and watch my 5 minutes of poorly delivered sex jokes. I couldn't bring myself to watch it with them, so I hid away in my bedroom. After 3 minutes, I heard my dad storm out, saying, "It's not even funny. It's just filth." Mum handed me back the tape with a look of pity on her face. "Maybe I should play a character," I said forlornly. "No," she said, "just be yourself. You are funny." I took both of their opinions on board and came up with new material. About them. The first proper routine I delivered was about how embarrassing it was when your parents used to drop you at school in front of the other kids and would insist on a kiss goodbye. The bit ended with me saying, "So one day I thought, do you know what? I've had enough. So I stuck the tongue in. Eh? It was the last time Dad ever dropped me to school." Finally, a bit of comedy that was clean. The first time I delivered at one of the Comedy Store regulars, a gentleman called Jim Burnett, who famously produced the Australian TV show Hey Hey It's Saturday, took me aside and said, "That's better. Keep talking about what you know." I talked about my grandparents, my childhood, and even started to chat to the crowd a little bit. By the time a journalist from the Sydney Morning Herald came along to review an open mic night, I was singled out as, quote, "the highlight of the night," with a fine ability to ad-lib under pressure and a penchant for talking about his family. Penchant. The original agreement was that I could only perform stand-up in my uni holidays, but after the summer break of 1989-90, I managed to convince my parents that comedy was the one career choice I was going to stick with. Not like that short-lived astronomy phase. They relented and said I could perform each Wednesday at the Comedy Store's open mic night. Every week I'd turn up an hour before the show, put my name into a hat, and await the outcome of the order. There were 10 spots on offer every night, 5 minutes each, and if more than 10 open micers arrived, the first out of the hat were on. The rest were guaranteed a spot the following week. I now know that we were lucky. I've heard that the Los Angeles Comedy Store often has up to 100 open spots arrive at 3 in the afternoon to vie for a position. In New York, apparently, there's a 3-month wait to do an open spot, and the same goes for the Comedy Store in London. In Sydney, though, in those pre-Fox Studio days where it was highly unlikely a film producer was going to drop in to scout for talent, there were about a dozen of us. The open micers became a fairly close-knit bunch, and our ranks included John Philpott, the bush psychiatrist from Dunedoo, Peter Berner, James O'Loughlin, Haskell Daniel and his amazing sound effects, Peter Sarley, later to be known as Akmal, Gary Eck, Anthony Murr and Dan McCartan. The last four later formed a show called All Aussie Are Bufta. There was Belinda Franks, Ian Trifford, Sylvia Karloff, Steady Eddie, and a softly spoken but exceedingly funny Irishman called Jim Owen. On the weekends, some of us would drop in to watch the professionals in action. We'd beg and plead for a five-minute spot, and if the manager, a brilliant, gorgeous, nurturing young woman called Ingrid, was feeling generous, she'd let us on stage. The Comedy Store was the only full-time comedy club in Sydney, and I missed it when I wasn't there. If I was out and about with friends on a Saturday night, I'd drop into the store on my way home to check out the late show. Once the audience had left, the comics on the bill, and any others who had also dropped in, would sit around, raid the bar, and swap gig stories. In many ways, this book is merely a collection of those stories. Every comedian has them. I was just sober enough to remember them, and nerdy enough to write them down. Like the time a couple of local actors appeared, wanting to try their hands at stand-up. Ooh, the tension! It was as if a group of rabbis had asked to join a pilgrimage to Mecca. These young upstarts reckoned they could do comedy. Not because they had a love of the art form, but because they weren't getting acting work and considered it a last resort. I mean, that's how we saw it anyway. To make matters worse, they had even brought along a group of friends to laugh at them. I mean, none of us would ever sink that low. To be fair, they weren't bad. The guy did a fairly amusing comedy lecture about his girlfriend, and the girl performed a skit as some sort of schoolgirl character. Their friends laughed, as did the audience, but we knew they wouldn't be back. Ha! Not as easy as it looks, is it? Maybe you should go back to your little acting classes and see if that makes you famous, we thought, but were too afraid to say. The schoolgirl character was a woman named Gia Carides, who went on to appear alongside Mike Myers in Austin Powers' The Spy Who Shagged Me. Lecture Boy, aka John Paulson, co-starred with Russell Crowe in one of my all-time favourite movies, The Sum of Us, as well as Mission Impossible 2 with Tom Cruise. He's also the man behind Sydney's Tropfest Short Film Festival. As for those in the audience, Naomi Watts is one of the movie world's hottest stars, appearing in David Lynch's Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks, and giving an Oscar-nominated performance in 21 Grams. I've since come to learn that actors and stand-up comics are completely different animals, each with different talents and skills, and each unable to understand fully what the other does. A friend told me recently of a wedding he attended in which the bride was an actor and the groom a comedian. One of the bride's thespian friends read a poem and delivered it with passion, pathos, poignancy and pride. As he returned to his seat, every actor in the room jumped to their feet in tears, applauding and nudging each other to say, "Wasn't he brilliant?" Every comedian in the room looked at each other and said, "What a wanker." "Oh my God, is that what I think it is?" asked the young male waiter who was staring over our shoulders, eyes locked on the stage. We followed his gaze and immediately gasped. From where we were sitting, side onto the performer, it appeared that he had a full... Well, no, it couldn't be. Maybe his pants were just sticking out at an odd angle. "Nope," countered the waiter. "That's definitely a hard-on." Another gasp. A swarm of questions buzzed around the table. Was he aroused by someone in the audience? Was it a prop? Did it develop while on stage, or did he bring it on with him? And finally, do you think it happens every time? Now, this thought was too bizarre to even contemplate. I mean, I felt a certain degree of excitement while performing, and to be brutally honest, have occasionally been slightly turned on by certain faces in the crowd. But I've never raised the Union Jack, so to speak. Surely he wouldn't be able to think straight. Besides, we'd been performing with him for at least 18 months now. You'd think we'd have noticed if he was always, you know, pitching a tent. He finished his five-minute set and exited the stage to a bemused and strangely silent green room. The following week, the open micers table was packed. At least a dozen comedy meerkats had assembled to check out Act Number 3's, material. And I have to say, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. The performer in
question... We hope you enjoyed this preview. To continue listening to this audiobook on Google Play Books, use the link in the video description.